the fourth case, the United States versus Foster. Ms. Winslow.
Good morning to the court. The government tried its case against Bernard Foster with a witness who was never required to testify.
He could have called him.
Well, Judge, we did, in fact, subpoena him. That's the second issue in this case. Perhaps I'll start with that, if that's what Your Honor's interested in. We did, in fact, the defense did, in fact, subpoena this witness. The confidential informant in this case was someone who was well-known to Mr. Foster. He was actually a family member. We did issue a subpoena prior to trial, and during trial, the government took actions to, in fact, defeat that subpoena. During trial, they met with the confidential informant after it became clear through investigation and testimony and taking, I think, a closer look at the recordings, it became clear that the confidential informant was, in fact, stealing money from the agents and hiding that money and lying to the agents about the amount of money he had given Mr. Foster.
But the jury heard all of that stuff.
They didn't, Your Honor. They heard the portion of it that the government chose to make part of a relevant part of their case. In fact, the real significance of part of that testimony would have been this. The government's investigation relies upon this notion that a confidential informant is searched prior to a meeting. The vehicle, the informant, their possessions are searched thoroughly, that there's no contraband, additional money, or drugs. That a meeting takes place that is partially observed, and then the informant is searched on the other end of the meeting. Once again, no contraband exists. In this case, the agents represented in their testimony that they did, in fact, conduct these searches, that their searches were sound, we'll call, and that no additional monies, drugs, or other contraband was found. That can't be true. We now know that the informant was, in fact, stealing money from the agents and that that money should have been accounted for in some way. It was in the car. It was on the informant. It was in some way hidden.
Well, wasn't he just going in there saying it cost, $5,000 when, in fact, he only paid $4,000?
That's right.
But he's saying he paid more than he did for the drugs.
That's right. And so when he leaves the meeting, he still has some of the government funds that were given to him to purchase the drugs. He still has that on his person. And yet the agents, despite their testimony about the integrity of their search, never found that money. That's an issue for the jury. These sort of controlled by cases, as the government calls them, depend upon the integrity of the search. They depend upon, in essence, the credibility of the confidential informant. In this case, there was evidence presented to the jury, some evidence presented to the jury, that the confidential informant was less than reliable, and I think that would be a way understatement. But what the jury didn't get to hear, and the confidential informant was never questioned about, was how he managed to secret these monies from the agents. The agents testified to the integrity of their search. Obviously, there was something missing from their search. So the confidential informant's testimony was extremely relevant. It would not have been cumulative, and it would have been, in fact, relevant to the jury's decision. But the government took steps, active steps, to defeat the defense's subpoena by, in essence, threatening the confidential informant with criminal charges. In this case,
that's not a threat. That's the truth.
Judge, it would be if he'd been charged. The confidential informant...
Well, eventually, but at the time.
Right. The harm was done. The crime was committed. The confidential informant lied to the agents, and he stole government funds. Those are crimes for which he would have a Fifth Amendment privilege to not testify. That's absolutely right. But during this period of time, he was working for the government. They knew about these offenses, and never did they charge him with the theft of government funds. Never did they charge him with lying to the agents. In fact, the only time he was threatened with charges is when he was making a decision about whether to respond to a defense subpoena.
But see, here's what I'm trying to figure out within your argument. Even after the CI announced that he was going to take the fifth. The district court told the defense that they could still call him to the stand if they wanted to examine him about subjects other than that problematic grand jury testimony for which he potentially faced, more than potentially, a perjury charge.
Well, he didn't face a perjury charge. He hasn't been charged. The only time the government was interested in charging him, and I will answer your question, the only time they were interested in charging him is when there was a possibility that he would take the stand in response to a defense subpoena. They're evidently no longer interested in charging him for lying to the grand jury, to lying to the agents, or for stealing government property, and I think that's an issue that should be addressed. But with respect to the district court's offer, there wasn't much left. The relevant points of fact, the relevant considerations for the CI's testimony were, in fact, his theft of government property and his lies to the grand jury. Simply having him take the stand to testify that he has prior convictions for perjury, that he had prior convictions for crimes of dishonesty would have been icing on the cake, but the jury already knew it. The agents so testified. So the relevant considerations were those that, in fact, he did have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege to, but the government wasn't interested in prosecuting him for those offenses and certainly could have given him immunity. The fact is, this was a government witness from the beginning. He was working on their behalf, and he created a series of facts that were dishonest. He created a situation in which the agents testified that they searched this man and that he didn't have any money on him. The government later came to learn that that wasn't true, and yet they took steps to keep the jury from hearing the whole story. The defendant had the right to subpoena him. His having taken the Fifth Amendment, exercised his Fifth Amendment privilege, as he did, the defense was entitled to a missing witness instruction. And the error, the harm that arose from the first issue, which is his failure to testify for the government in the first place, was compounded by the fact that the district court erroneously deprived the defense of the ability to argue the missing witness.
What would he have said?
Pardon me, Judge?
Just if he were a witness, what would you want to prove?
If the government had, and I think they should have, if the government had given him immunity, as they should have, he would have told the jury just what he told the agents in that fateful meeting, that in fact, during the period of time he was cooperating with the government, he was stealing government funds, that he was hiding them someplace in his vehicle or on his person. And from that, an inference could be made, and an argument surely would have, that the agent's search was not as sound as they represented to the jury to begin with. That's a question for the jury. And the jury should have had the ability to hear all of the facts and understand what was really happening in this case.
I don't recall if you notice United States versus Raphael, that 11th Circuit case. Quote, every circuit to have considered this question has held that the government's mere ability to grant immunity without more does not make a witness who invokes the Fifth Amendment right not to testify peculiarly available to the government within the meaning of the missing instruction witness.
Judge, I don't know if I cite that case, but I do cite that proposition. And I think it's overcome in this case by the government's abuse of discretion and, I would argue, misconduct. And if I could just address the issue of the Sixth Amendment and the right to confront witnesses, the government's case relied upon the CI's testimony and the CI's conduct. Rule 801 of the Federal Rules of Evidence clearly state that nonverbal conduct can also be a statement. In this case, the agent's testimony solely involved the conduct and statements of the CI. And I would point, Your Honors, to a few specific instances which I think illustrate the point in this particular case. The first is the transcript for February 12th of 2009. The CI states, that's 56, supposed to be 60, followed shortly by the comment, the quantity is off. Nothing about that statement, those statements, does anything to place a statement by Mr. Foster in context. Mr. Foster doesn't say anything. Mr. Foster doesn't utter any comments about quantity. The reason that these particular statements were relevant is because they were used by the government later in its closing argument to say, you know that Mr. Foster gave the CI 56 grams of crack cocaine because you can hear it on the tape. The CI says that's 56, supposed to be 60. In fact, this is the case that this court has warned against in both Nettles and Silva. This is the case in which it's the CI's statements, the CI's testimony, essentially, on the tapes, that is driving the government's evidence. This is not the case in which the statements that were made by the CI are simply putting anything by Mr. Foster in context. In fact, Your Honors have the transcripts. I know they're part of the record, as certainly are the recordings. Mr. Foster has very little to say about anything. It's really the CI's comments, the CI's statements that run the government's case, run the government's evidence in this case. Additional examples are found in every transcript, but again, in the 2009 transcript, the CI states clearly that he's weighing something and counting something. Again, for the government to argue in closing, he's weighing drugs and counting money. Finally, the CI states, police are coming right here, I'm gone. Most notably would be the April 2nd transcript, in which the CI engages in a long conversation, in essence, with himself about how Mr. Foster should, in fact, just introduce him to his original source so they could cut out the middleman and save the money. If Your Honors have no further questions,
I assume that was one of their objectives. I think, didn't they finally get the source, whatever?
They did. They did get the source, Judge.
Yeah, so I assumed that this was part of the process. They were trying to find out who the next guy up was. So
I would assume that's a valid investigatory technique. I don't think that trumps the Sixth Amendment and the right to have the CI testify. I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Winslow. Mr. Parenti.
May it please the Court. My name is Chris Parenti. I represent the United States. Judges, let's be clear. The United States did not act here to defeat the CI from testifying. The United States did everything it could to discover the untruths that the CI was concealing in this case. It was the government, let me remind you, that found out what went wrong here. It was the government that, when they noticed that discrepancy, called in the CI and confronted the CI, not to keep him from testifying, because let's keep in mind, everything bad the CI had to say and would have said when he testified came in. As Your Honor said, the jury heard all of that. The jury heard the CI's terrible criminal history. The jury heard the fact that the CI was being paid by law enforcement. And most importantly, the jury heard that the CI was stealing from ATF. It was offered in the government's opening statement. It was highlighted in the defendant's opening statement. It was brought out through the testimony on direct from the agent. He was crossed extensively on it. The government was not hiding anything. The government's the one that discovered this problem and brought it to the defense's knowledge.
Why hasn't he been charged with perjury? Not that it's my business, but
the fact is he has not been charged. It was vetted in the office and the decision was made not to prosecute him. At the time, this is happening in real time, and at that time, it wasn't known what was going to happen. We just found out that a witness was stealing from us and lying to us. And so we're not going to just grant immunity on the spot to this witness. We're going to investigate what happened here and try to figure that out. And what's important here is what the district court, who's watching this happen in real time, says. The district court said, I don't see any evidence in this case that there was any attempt by the government to manipulate the availability of this witness or the witness's determination to invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege. And that was the judge who's watching this happen and sees that the government was surprised at what happened and sees that it was the government that did everything it could to uncover the truth.
Wouldn't it have been meaningful for the jury to hear how the CI was stealing the money?
It could have been, and defense counsel had the opportunity to do that because you don't need the CI for that. And there's a really telling example here, Your Honor, where on the cross of the agent, defense counsel is about to get into this, and she is about to ask the agent the question of, well, wait a minute, how did you miss this money? And the government calls a sidebar to warn defense counsel that if you ask this question, the likely answer will be the way that this scheme worked and the way that it was not detected was because the defendant was in on it. And so if you ask that question, he's going to say, well, the way it happened was he overpaid him and then he met up with the defendant later and they split the money. So defense counsel at that point backs away. They don't want to get into this issue because they know it hurts their client. It hurts the defense to say, yeah, my client was in on it. So the defendant actually got the best of both worlds here, right? They got the jury to hear how dirty the CI is without ever hearing the fact that the defendant was in on the stealing of the money here. And if you look at this in the context of a missing witness instruction, which is how it's raised, it would be completely inappropriate in this case to give a missing witness instruction because you're saying here that the government could call this witness and it would provide, you can infer it would hurt the government's evidence. And that's not true here. First of all, the government couldn't call this witness. This witness was represented by private counsel and it had invoked the Fifth Amendment privilege. So the government had no control over this witness. And second, it wouldn't have really hurt the government because all the bad things that the CI could have said were already said and told to the jury. In fact, the only thing that would have happened is it would have helped the government's case because then the jury would have heard that the reason that this happened was because the CI was actually splitting it with the defendant later on. Turning to the hearsay issues, the district court here did not plainly err in admitting these statements because this is textbook statements that came in for context. And the jury was given a specific instruction here not to consider these statements for the truth. And if you actually look at the full transcripts which the court has, and you read the CI statements, they're all immaterial. The only reason they're even relevant is because of the fact that they give context to the defendant's statements. This statement that was cited by defense counsel here was about the weight. That's 56, should have been 60. The government didn't put that in for the truth. It didn't matter that it was 56 or 60. In fact, we had a chemist come in and testify it was 57.8, I believe. We didn't need to establish the weight through the CI. That statement is relevant because it was short. The defendant then knocks the price down. That's why those statements are relevant. On its own, it doesn't matter. And the government never offered that statement for the truth. It offered it for the context. You can't play these recordings without the CI statements. It makes no sense. None of the CI statements in here were argued or offered for the truth, and it was the government that gave the jury instruction, jury, do not take any of these statements for the truth. If your honors have no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the conviction and judgment in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Perrini. Ms. Winslow?
Very briefly, Your Honor. First of all, the question of whether or not immunity could have been granted, I just find it disingenuous that the government argues that this was happening in real time. In fact, the government, the Department of Justice, is more than capable of granting immunity in situations in which it's called for on a very short notice. The second question is that the defendant was in on it is equally disingenuous. The government proposes that the defendant could have been participating in a scheme to steal government funds that, in fact, he would receive back at a later time. They would meet up at a later time and take part of those government funds, suggests that the defendant knew he was part of a recorded buy situation, and that was the reason he couldn't just be given the funds at the time. It makes very little sense. It's confusing to me, and it does nothing to undermine the question of the integrity of the agent search. Regardless of whether or not Mr. Foster met up with the CI later, which I firmly believe he didn't, it does not undermine the point that the agent's search was not nearly as perfect as they portrayed it. Finally, the government argues that they did not rely on any of these comments. Well, that was 56. It was supposed to be 60. And I would refer Your Honors to page 547 of the transcript in the closing argument cited in the brief. If there's no further questions.
Well, just one, Ms. Winslow. Ms. Brenny spoke about the opportunity that was available on extended cross of the agent. Do you want to respond to whether that would have been sufficient?
It would not have been sufficient, Judge. I mean, the agent's answer would have been, we don't know, but he was meeting up with your client later. That would have opened up what I think is a almost demonstrably false statement about Mr. Foster. Certainly risks had to be weighed at the moment. But the agent himself, based on the report of the interview with the CI in which he collapsed on the floor and went through all of the melodrama, doesn't indicate that he ever told the agents how he hid the money.
What about the ability to examine on the question of how they searched the CI?
We examined them extensively on that, Judge, extensively.
Okay, thank you.
There's nothing further, Your Honors. I'd ask that you reverse this case and grant Mr. Foster a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Winslow. Ms. Winslow, in addition to the thanks I just extended, I want to give you an additional thanks to the court for representing Mr. Foster, accepting the appointment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.